Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. AVE's latest primetime attraction is What's It Worth? Where Jeff Foxworthy searches for valuables that turn up in the most unexpected places. Executive producer Adam Freeman joins me next. Award-winning composer Nathan Ball returns to our program later this hour. He's up for not one, but two 2020 Primetime Emmy Awards for his themes for the Amazon series Carnival Row and the Netflix series Hollywood. And moreover, Quincy, there's a new corner on the tube. We are happening, it's happening, by the way, Wednesdays on the CW. It's called Corner. And we will have creator and executive producer Morwen Bremner and executive producer and lead director Adrian Mitchell tell all in our final 30 minutes. Also ahead, AMC and Hulu bust loose with news notes, our new classic trivia question winner, and our takeaway of the week. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow we televise, brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get 2 free audiobooks when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. 78 degrees at the top of the hour here in New York, nice and sunny at the moment. And we welcome you to week one, episode 2 of our 14th year of the program all about TV's current and future. We have a jam-packed 90 minutes for you, a lot of great guests from all over the place, and we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. Pick up the phone and dial in with this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio. We got a chat room going, SimonApple04 by name, that's the name, and you'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. So use the phone order and lead the way. You're interactive with us. And while the program is on the air, you can connect up by visiting Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk, Spreaker, or TuneIn screen, follow the instructions of keeping live with you. Our big 90-minute edition begins with Adam Freeman from What's It Worth on A&E. He will join us from California after these news notes. The two big news-making TV ventures this afternoon, AMC Networks and Hulu. At AMC, futuristic anthology series Soulmate, set to debut October 5th, has picked up a second season, without the first season getting an episode on the air in the first place. In another development, four writer-producers have set up shop at AMC Studios unit to create scripted, unscripted true crime series. And rounding out matters, Daniel Day Kim and Katie Chang will co-star in Pantheon at AMC's upcoming hour-long animated drama series. And now the Hulu development, the great co-star Ellie Fanning will follow that star turn at the service with miniseries The Girl from Plainville, based on a true case of texting suicide 3 years ago. Elsewhere, Selena Gomez will join Steve Martin and Martin Short as co-star in mystery satire Only Murders in the Building. Love, Victor and Taste the Nation will be back for second season, and look for a second series from Chef David Chang, The Next Thing You Eat. Chang's first family style has not been scheduled yet. And now a bunch of quickies before our first guest. Amid all the TikTok brouhaha, the venture's content is now available on smart TV sets, at least one. Amazon Fire TV. We're not kidding. That was confirmed in a story published earlier today. Keep waiting for that HBO Max Friends reunion special planned to start filming this month or kaput. More Hulu news, and long last, the Animaniacs revival will begin this November. Yes, Steven Spielberg is involved. Amazon has acquired Small Axe, that's Oscar-winning filmmaker Steve McQueen's anthology series, for presentation this fall. BET and BET Her will simulcast the 30th annual Stellar Awards, considered gospel music's top honor, on August 23rd. It will then go a couple days later into broadcast syndication. And finally, HBO Max and Ava DuVernay will turn popular Twitter stream One Perfect Shot into a television series. And that is news notes for today. Wow, a very big news note day on this Friday. Over the years, we have brought you various programs from Think Factor Media, a company that has done a lot of work in particular with A&E. That's of A&E, History Channel, and their other networks, both scripted and unscripted. Their latest venture is a show called What It's Worth, which is running on Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. It has Jeff Foxworthy, you know him as the You Want to Be a Redneck comedian, and then, of course, the host of Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader on Fox and Syndication and American Bible Challenge on GSN. In this show, Mr. F is scouring the country for valuables that people don't think they have. but in fact, they do. And it's a show that originally was going to go live, but because of the coronavirus pandemic, had to change its format. And so far, so good. Joining us live from Calabasas, California, is one of the key people at Think Factory Media. He is president of content. He's also the executive producer of this series, Adam Freeman. Adam, great to have you aboard.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And same here. Adam, how is What It's Worth doing so far?
It's doing great. It's we premiered this past Tuesday, and everyone's real excited. And as long as, you know, we do what every show hopes to do, which is grow week to week, we'll be in awesome shape.
How long was this program in development for? What finally got it on A&E?
That's a great question. We were in development for a long time. The A&E network family was always passionate about the concept. They couldn't decide which home it would be best for. So when we originally pitched the show, I think it was purchased by A&E, but then for a little while during the development, they thought it might be better suited for history. Then they moved us back over to A&E when we kind of came up with the big live concept. So it's been about a year or so on and off of developing this. So we're so psyched that it finally got to see the light of day.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the format and how it works. We'll get into what you had to do to go from live to virtual in a little bit. But let's get into the format for the people who haven't seen the program yet.
Sure. It's really simple, and I think that's what people like about it. It's Jeff Foxworthy from his basement in Atlanta, Georgia, and he virtually drops in on people all around the country that think they have something that might be valuable. And Jeff is joined by three of his friends / expert appraisers, and they give their opinion on what the item could fetch in the marketplace. Sometimes the answer is amazing. Sometimes it's not so amazing, but they always give an answer.
Mm-hmm. You could see how Jeff would do a show like this, especially coming off what he did in the world of game shows with Fifth Grader and American Bible Challenge. I thought he did a very good job. He really used the clock very well. He worked the best out of contestants. He was very inquisitive and made the show a lot of fun, no matter whether you were a kid or an adult, in the case of Fifth Grader.
Well, Jeff is he loves people. And he loves talking to people. He loves learning things about people. So, and he could talk to anyone about anything. And he doesn't feign interest. He's honestly interested. So that was obviously drew us to him immediately. Obviously, everybody knows that he's funny. He's one of the top grossing comedians of all time. We know that he's smart and that he can run a show because he did that for Fifth Grader. And he's passionate about, as he puts it, old stuff. He collects Americana and Native American artifacts himself. It was like the perfect storm for him to host this show.
How does Jeff find out about the valuables that he is pursuing?
Well, we have our producers go out and they cast a net far and wide asking people if they have something that they think it's worth, and it comes to us, and we kind of, you know, vet them, and then we talk over with Jeff. We don't tell him what the result is, but we talk over with Jeff we decide as a team what we're going to cover in the show, and then we go for it, and he's as surprised in the moment as the owner of the island.
What did work? It's the brand new A&E series, started last week. It's now running Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, and we got the executive producer, Adam Freeman, with us live from Calabasas, California this half hour. On Tomorrow will be televised. Tom Abercrombie with you live from New York. We're just getting started. 9-minute episode coming your way as we wrap up week one of our 14th year on the air. And we invite you to be interactive with us. All you got to do, pick up the phone and make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Monday on Tomorrow Be Televised, we will preview what may be one of the biggest developments in broadcast journalism this year. On September 1st, WGN America will launch and turn over its prime time to a 3-hour block called News Nation. It will involve NextStar's 5,000 journalists at their broadcast stations all over the country and originate from Chicago. We'll have an exclusive interview with the weeknight anchors of the program, Joe Dolan and Marnie Hughes. And incidentally, News Nation will be on 7 nights a week. It will be replayed in late night, and ultimately it will also become a 24/7 smart TV programming service. Also, Speaking of smart TVs, we'll get some insight into how things are going in that programming theme from Whistle Al. The company has been doing some very interesting research of late about the arena, and we'll have spokesperson Sherry Riggs will join us. That's coming up on Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Smartly Televised as week 2 of year 14 kicks off. What have the people who Jeff visits, what do they think about their valuables? What have they learned about the visit and about how they see some of the things, their possessions, and have they seen it in a different way than they originally thought?
Well, it's interesting. You know, one of the things that Jeff brought up immediately was that every item has two values, right? It has the monetary value, but it has the sentiment behind it and the emotional value. And what we found is some people have no idea what they have, and they consider it a piece of junk, and they're just curious. Some people are convinced they have a hidden gem, and some people have something that just means a lot to them. And they just want to know more about the object, and whether it's a dollar or $1 million, they are not willing to part with it because it's very sentimental. So really what they're looking for is information. The price is great, but with some people, that it's something so important to them, they're never going to part with it. So it's more just for, you know, for their edification. It's not like they're going to go out and buy a new house necessarily.
What are some of the items that have been featured so far?
It's been such a wide range of pop culture, historic. You know, in the first week alone, we had, let me think. Well, we had a 6-foot-tall wooden statue of Gabriel that the family thought might have been constructed for a pope at one point. We had a newspaper announcing the death of President Lincoln the day after his assassination. It ranges far, far and wide. We've had movie paraphernalia, props. We really cover the gamut of everything.
Mm-hmm. Now, how far were you in production before the pandemic hit? Because my understanding is that A&E originally was going to do this live, as in like live PD. How soon in production were you when the pandemic hit, and then you had to make a change?
Well, it's interesting. It's to be factually correct, the big live show is still happening. What we had to do was slide it because we need to wait until it's a little safer to do so. And then the discussion came up of, well, what can you do between now and the live show now that we have this time slot? So we came up with this show as kind of a precursor to the larger big live auction show. So we were in casting and, you know, and looking for items, and then we just kind of, you know, shifted a bit to focus on people that we would, you know, go into their homes virtually. But it was not a hard adjustment to make, you know. And what we loved about this concept was that, yes, it was able to be produced in these crazy times, but it is a show that you would watch or that you would pitch and create regardless of what the situation, you know, was with COVID in the world. So that's what we loved about it. Was we didn't want it to feel like, oh, this is just a placeholder or this is just a little thing we came up with because of the, you know, the world. This is something that hopefully goes on for years and years. It doesn't matter what situation the world is in. We're virtually going into people's homes.
Yeah. Before I ask about the status of the live edition, what did you learn about doing it virtually? You said that it was an easier adjustment to make this happen.
It was an easy adjustment creatively. The technology is still a brand new world. And everyone, you know, there's a million different things out there that news is trying, that other shows are trying. So the technology was probably the biggest challenge because we wanted the show, obviously, to have a certain production value, and we wanted Jeff to be able to communicate freely. And, you know, he's a comedian. He thrives off of interaction, so you don't want there to be delays and things like that. So the technology was the biggest challenge, but by the end of the run, we had smoothed it out pretty much. But it was That's those first day or two in rehearsals and stuff were scary.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to, when you went into people's homes and set up their cameras, did you have to look for, like, what's the most photogenic room or videogenic room to use where they show the items? Or how do you make the show as mobile as possible so that, let's say, if one of the subjects has to go up to the attic to find something, or go to the kitchen to find something, or go somewhere else in the house or the apartment, it could be done in a pretty easy manner?
That's a great question. Well, what we did was we definitely kind of virtually scouted their homes beforehand. Our producers did, whether it was on FaceTime or Skype, and the owners would, you know, walk our producers around the house and kind of give them a tour. But virtually every house we went into, they had two camera feeds. So they usually had a fixed camera, and then they had an iPhone or a tablet or something handheld. So if they wanted to get up and walk around, they had that flexibility. It was really important to us that we get as much movement and have as much freedom as possible, so it didn't feel like, you know, you were watching CNBC or something, and it was talking heads. And I think we accomplished that. I think people had a lot of fun. I think it added that an air of unpredictability and craziness, which is great. And that's, as a comedian used to dealing with live audiences, that's what Jeff thrives on.
You know, as you were just talking about that, Anna, it reminded me back in the 1950s, Edward R. Murrow, the great journalist, did a series called Person to Person, where he every week would go into one or two celebrity houses, and he would have the celebrity in the house, and you would have to see the camera moving around, hopefully as unjerky as possible, black and white in those days,
as
the person was giving like a guided tour of the house, the patio, what's going on with the family, and all that. So it sort of reminds me that this is like, in a way, person to person circa 2020.
Yeah, and look, and it sounds like Murrow invented MTV Cribs, so he doesn't get credit for that.
Yeah. At that time, it was not virtual TV. It was live TV at the time.
Yeah.
Although it was planned, like your show, the move, the camera movement and what the celebrity would do was planned in advance. Although it was made in such a way it was improvisational, it was very, like, conversational with
We wanted
Murrow
to give people as much freedom. We wanted to give the owners and Jeff as much freedom as possible. We didn't want people to be stiff. We didn't want people to think, oh, I can only stand in this 4-foot square area. And them being in their homes naturally made them more comfortable. You know, that's usually the biggest challenge when you're working with everyday people off the street, is you don't know whether when they get into a studio under the lights, are they going to freeze, or are they going to get nervous, or are they going to say something silly. So Jeff was really a guest in their homes, and they were very, very welcoming, and it made it much more personal. It was, to them, Jeff was in their personal space, which was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
How valuable are the items that you feature in terms of dollar amount?
We've had everything from $0 to $5 to $500,000. It runs the entire gamut, and we really look for that. We didn't want everything to be an out-of-the-park home run. We wanted a mixture. And sometimes when you have an item that is either a reproduction or it's not as factually accurate as you think it is, there still is interesting takeaway and interesting conversation as far as deciphering how you know that and how you detect that. So we tried to make every item as interesting as possible regardless of the value. But with picking the items, it was really a combination of the item itself, the value of the item, and the story of the person that owns it, because that's equally as fascinating. You know, we didn't want people that were diehard collectors. We didn't want people that bought something as an investment. We wanted people that either stumbled upon something in a garage sale, or were something was handed down from their grandfather, or, you know, they found it in their house when they moved in. We really wanted the stories to really shine as much as the item.
As we speak, we're now seeing efforts by individual states to reopen television production. New York City and New York State, Atlanta, with Tyler Perry and some of the things he's doing, Florida, California, we're starting to see the soap operas are now starting to be back in production, or in some cases getting their new episodes on the air. what does it look like in terms of instituting the live format of What It's Worth?
It really comes down to scale, and it comes down to at what point can we produce the project that we're all excited about and that we envisioned. The live version of What's It Worth is really going to be an exciting kind of town hall marketplace. So what we're really doing is working on how and when we can do that safely, because obviously everyone's health is the most important. So when we can properly test and get results that fast with a lower false positive rate and everything, and we can have a big group of people together excited to bid on items and to present their items, then we'll do it. You know, and that's been a moving target. So it's been very challenging, but the enthusiasm for the show hasn't waned, and we're just dying to bring it to people because we think it's going to be so much fun.
The program is What It's Worth, hosted by Jeff Foxworthy. Think Factory Media has put it together, and the next episode is this coming Tuesday at 9 p.m. Pacific Time on A&E. Adam Freeman is the executive producer of the program. He's also a key executive at the production company that makes it. Think Factory Media will find out what they're up to as a whole shortly. If you have a question or comment on our remaining minutes with Adam, make the call 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Before there was Survivor, before there was The Amazing Race, there was Eco Challenge, and Amazon has got it. And next Friday on Tomorrow Be Televised, we will have as our lead guest the executive producer of the new version of Eco Challenge, Lisa Hennessy. And then we'll meet up with the chief executive of a production company called Triple Squirrel that this week put together a brand new smart TV distributed programming service featuring talent from the Pacific Northwest. The service is called Evergreen, E-V-E-R-G-R-N, and involves the Emmy Award-winning actor from Picket Fences, Tom Skerritt. We'll feature the chief executive of Triple Squirrel, Leslie Grandy, with us. That's all coming up next Friday, 1 week from today, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific. It should be a dandy right here on Tomorrow We Televise. Even more of a dandy when you are interacting with us. How is Think Factory doing in light of this pandemic, and what projects do you have in production for the future?
Well, ironically, we're busier than we've ever been. We were really expecting to slow down when the pandemic hit, and right when things started to heat up, things heated up for us in an odd way. So, you know, we have our two long-running returning franchises on WE TV, Marriage Boot Camp and All Its Different Incarnations, and Mama June from Not the Hot. So those have been in constant production for years now, and we're still going on those. And then we have a lot of other exciting things. I hope to be able to come back and talk to you when they are officially announced, but I could give you the frustrating broad strokes. You know, we have a great format right now at TBS. We have a great format at History. We just had a special air on Lifetime called Happily Ever Altered that we're hoping will get picked up for more episodes. We have a series at OWN that's going to be announced soon. So It has not slowed down for us, and that's not a complaint, because I'm happy to be busy and to be employed, and I'm proud of the entire Think Factory family. I know how difficult it's been in this industry, but we have never, ever been busier than the last couple of months.
Your company over the years has done some outstanding work both in scripted and unscripted programming, and now we're in this mega programming era where you have Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus, you have HBO Max and Peacock that have launched earlier this year. You have an expanding CBS All Access. There is talk about maybe another mega service or two. And, of course, you have Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, all these smart TV programming services that have popped up since the start of the year. What do you think about this environment? And are you and your colleagues, your executive colleagues, sort of planning, like, where do you want to be with all these services? Where do you want to be with all these networks?
Well, obviously, in a perfect world, you want to be in business with all of them. The irony is there are more buyers than ever before, but it's becoming more and more challenging to sell. I think each one of these outlets have a very narrow needle that they want to thread. They have very particular needs. A lot of them, like the Hulus of the world, are brand new and they're kind of finding their footing. So they thought they wanted a lot of one particular thing, and now they're adjusting and finding that sea leg. So for us, really, it has to do with the concept. Where is the best home for it? When it comes to pure, like, putting sweat equity into developing a project, how many buyers can you take it to? I think that's what you're finding more and more with these buyers, is that it used to be, you know, 20 years ago, you would develop a show and you could take the same show to every network, you know, all four of them, three of them. You know, now everybody has such specific wants and needs that you really have to decide, okay, if we're going to put enough energy into developing this, shooting something, whatever it may be, is it worth doing that to pitch it to one place, or can you pitch it to two or three places with slight adjustments? So that's the big focus for us, is we really want to work smarter, and we want to be in business with everyone, but we also can't put all of our eggs in one basket and keep going after, you know, the one white whale, and ignore all of our other network partners. So we are constantly shifting. We're constantly getting updates from the networks themselves, what they're looking for. Sometimes it perfectly aligns with something that we're thinking of. Sometimes it's an easy adjustment. Sometimes we know, oh, we can fill that hole with X. It's every day is different. Every need is different. And kind of the plan of attack for everything is different.
And I'll tell you something, the appetite of all these services is just humongous, and it's getting bigger by the day. I was reading our news notes, and it's like you're seeing all these news notes, all these program development deals with individuals, with production companies, the effort to do more diversity programming. It's just absolutely incredible where things are going. And then, again, we have more and more of these networks on smart TV sets and smart devices that are coming up in the woods that eventually could become major players for scripted and unscripted.
Yeah, I think it's really going to depend on the consumer. I think it's going to depend on how much a person's wallet can support, how much they're willing to support. You know, yes, there are lots of challenges with the basic cable model, you know, where you're just getting a package of all these channels. But when you have everything that's a la carte, there's eventually going to be challenges there too, because how many $6.99 or $9.99 or $12.99 charges per month is the average person going to want? It's going to really come down to content. It's going to come down to what shows each streamer has and how many people want that show, you know. And I think what you're going to end up finding is, much like HBO, much like AMC, much like FX, I think that these streamers, I think their brands, if you want to call it that, are going to have to become quality. It's you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be the home shopping network, the outdoor life network, the American Heroes network. I think it's going to be, I want to go to Disney Plus because I know their stuff is great. I want to go to Netflix because I know their shows are great. And quality always rises to the top, and I think that's what we're going to see happening. I think that there are a lot of players out there. I'm curious whether in 2 or 3 years all those players will still be there. I hope they are. It gives me more places to sell. But you don't know. As always, the consumer is going to decide.
And we should point out that both A&E and AMC now have their own studios units where they are producing for as many players as they can, aside from their own family of networks. What's It Worth with Jeff Foxworthy? Next episode, this coming Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on A&E. Check your local listings for where that network is available in the area on cable and satellite. And for more details about the program online, here's where you go, www.aetv.com. That's www.aetv.com. And for more details about Think Factory Media and its wide variety of original scripted and unscripted programming now and in the future, www.thinkfactorymedia.com. That's www.thinkfactorymedia.com. Adam Friedman, head of content and executive producer of What's Worth, thank you again for joining us from California. Congratulations on getting this new show off the ground, hopefully a long-running one, both the current version and hopefully down the road the live version, and it's been a delight to have you with us. We'd love to have you come back.
I'd love to come back. Thanks for the support. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Adam. Take care of you and everybody at Think Factory, and have a sensational weekend.
Thank you very much. You too.
Adam Friedman from Think Factory Media joining us live from Calabasas, California. More tomorrow, we televised the first confined word from the folks at Audible.com. If you're into fantasy, Twilight idea, how about this audiobook, Midnight Sun by Stephanie Meyer? And you can get it as one of not one, but two audiobooks that you can get when you subscribe for a one-month trial at Audible.com. Now, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and inspiration. Over 200,000 titles to choose from, and you listen on any device, whatever you're hearing us on right now, at Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, and iHeartRadio. Just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, and you get two free audiobooks. One from the entire catalog, and another from the growing catalog of Audible Originals. We're talking one woman, one man shows, the best of Broadway, off-Broadway, and regional theater, and great original audio productions you can't get anywhere else. And it's all for the one-month trial with great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com. So how about having today or this weekend, for you or someone you love, be the time that you find out how Audible.com can transform the way you hear the world. For all the details, Audibletrial.com/televised. Coming up next, would you believe that someone who 7 years ago was doubly nominated for a Primetime Emmy Award has got the same situation again? That's happening to award-winning composer Nathan Barr. He joins us live from Connecticut after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You're connected to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio, TuneIn, and Spreaker.com. Together, reach over 45 million listeners around the world every month and growing. And remember, TuneIn Radio is your home for the 24/7 coronavirus news channel. Get all the latest developments on this pandemic from all over the world, plus podcasts, other original material as well. The Coronavirus News Channel, 24/7, everything your source on TuneIn Radio at TuneIn.com. Welcome back to Lobby Televised as we continue our 90-minute edition of Week 1. Day 2 of the program All About TV's Current and Future, startup year 14. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Your questions and comments for our guests ahead. What you got to do is pick up the phone and dial in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Later in this hour, we've got our latest classic trivia winner, which, by the way, has a musical question attached. But right now, for the second Friday in a row, we have a 2020 Primetime Emmy nominee. Last Friday, it was Nina Erb, who is an editor on the popular HBO series with Issa Rae, Insecure. In this case, we've got one of the top TV composers around. 7 years ago, that's right, 7 years ago, he was nominated for 2 Primetime Emmy Awards in the same category, theme music, for his excellent work on the Peabody Award-winning series, The Americans, and on the Netflix series, Hemlock Grove. His work has also graced other such shows as True Blood, the popular long-running HBO series. Well, guess what? Last week, he was nominated again for 2 Primetime Emmy Awards for 2 different shows, the Amazon adventure drama Carnival Row and Ryan Murphy's latest for Netflix, Hollywood. Joining us live from Greenwich, Connecticut, Nathan Barr. Nathan, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Simon. It's actually 3 nominations this year, 2 for Hollywood and 1 for Carnival Row.
What are the odds? What are the odds, Nathan, that 7 years apart, you would have multiple Emmy nominations in the same category?
Yes, it's strange. I guess there have been other years where I've written more than one theme in the same year, but to get it again this year on 2 shows like Carnival Row and Hollywood is just, it's a little bit stunning, staggering rather.
And how do you get 2 nominations for the same program?
So one of my nominations for Hollywood is for main title theme, and one is for underscore of the same show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The underscoring in Hollywood. I picked one of the episodes that I was particularly proud of, and then it's the main title themes for Carnival Row and Hollywood.
Let's talk about both shows. Let's start with Carnival Row, one of the 2 theme nominations. It's an adventure show, but not the kind of adventure that you did for so many years with the Americans. What kind of a challenge was it to sort of capture the environment of that series in a theme?
Yeah, I mean, Carnival Row is a beautifully told visual story, hatched by Travis Beecham. And it was just a really beautiful world to delve into, you know, obviously cut from a similar cloth to Lord of the Rings and fantasy epics like that. And at the end of the day, it's like all about plugging into the human story, the human aspect that everyone relates to, even though it's the sort of fantastical world. And that was really easy to do with Orlando Bloom's character Philo and then the character Vignette. Cara Delevingne. So yeah, it was just really about plugging into the human story and that takes some of the pressure off trying to do something completely different.
And what style did you go for in the writing of the music?
I mean, I went for, like, so obviously there have been a lot of really wonderful fantasy films and shows over the years. So that, so in the past 100 years, there's a sort of a, these tropes that one returns to, and they just work really well. So in the case of this choir, it seemed like a really good thing to lean into. So we got a nine-person choir, nine women, to sing a lot of the themes in the show at various moments, and that really helped sort of blow up the expansiveness of it and meet at the really high level that the visuals were creating for the show. And then it's a lot of, like, unusual instruments that I have a solo cello that I invented with these sympathetic strings on it, and a drone that gets used quite a bit, and a nickel harpa. And then I have this big Wurlitzer theater organ with 1,366 pipes that not only got used in the main title, but also in the body of the underscore of the show as well. So that became a very central sound that the producers got excited about.
How did you come up with the idea of the choir? When you were saying that, it reminded me of a 1950s Western, The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, which used a choir, Ken Darby's group, to do the underscore. It was pretty much for every episode. It was and the theme music, also written by the great Harry Warren of Lullaby of Broadway fame. Wyatt Earp, Brave, Courageous, and Bold. It was all done by choir.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, choir is just very evocative, no matter how you use it. And I think it needs to be a visually rich canvas to handle choir a lot of the time. And in this case, the production design, the makeup, the costumes, it's all just really beautiful and expansive and big. And so I think the choir definitely plugged into that. It also plugs into the emotional side of just the sound of a human voice singing a melody really is a very evocative and emotional thing. And so it made sense to lean into that.
Now, with Ryan Murphy's Hollywood, no matter what critics thought about the show itself, there was a lot of praise for the ambiance, the photography, your music, the whole look of the show that got people thought, like, this is, you know, classic Hollywood time, 1930s, 1940s. Did you do a lot of research to sort of have the music be that way?
Yeah, I mean, the most important marching orders I got, if you can call them that, from Alexis Woodall, who's Ryan Murphy's really wonderful right hand, were just the importance of memorable tunes to the Ryan Murphy camp, no matter what show they're doing. And so it came down to, like, being able to write a tune that was memorable in the style of those tunes of that time period. And it's not something I've had a lot of opportunity to do, and so it was a real pleasure to figure that out. And I was like, a fish in water exploring that world just with all the traditional jazz elements. And I'd say, you know, 4 to 6 pretty strong, pretty relevant and prevalent themes in the show that get plugged into, and Ryan Murphy and Alexis and the editors are very much behind the idea of themes getting used over and over again to help have the audience associate with those characters emotionally or wherever the story's going at a given point.
Did you try to recreate the ambience of the music of the movies in that time period? You had some of the great composers of all time writing for movies, whether it's Max Steiner at Warner Brothers, Eric Korngold at Warner Brothers, or Scott Bradley at MGM doing the Tom and Jerry cartoons, or some of the other great, or Miklos Rosa doing all those mystery, you know, film noir dramas.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favorite periods in film music. It is an extraordinary time, and certainly in my own humble way, yes, that was the intent, was to sort of go there. There was sometimes people are doing a period piece and they want to stay away from being too period and lean into some contemporary elements, and that was not the case with this. I think, as you saw with the makeup and production design and everything else, it was a real homage to that time period by really plugging into recreating that time period as best as possible with people today.
We're speaking with award-winning composer Nathan Barr. 7 years ago, he was nominated twice for the Emmy Award in the same category for his work on the Peabody Award-winning series The Americans and on Hemlock Grove on Netflix. Americans, of course, on FX. Now he is up for not one, not two, 3 Primetime Emmy Awards in music categories, 2 for theme music for Carnival Row on Amazon and Ryan Murphy's Hollywood on Netflix, and plus a music score for one of the episodes of Hollywood, also on Netflix. Natives with us live from Greenwich, Connecticut this half hour. On tomorrow will be televised. Signing off, I'll be live from New York. Delighted you're aboard on this Friday of August 2020 as we wrap up the first week of year 14 of the program All About the Tube. If you have a question or comment for Nathan, give us a call. What you got to do is hit this number, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04, by name. By the way, coming up later this month, among our guests, we'll have actor and entrepreneur Ravi Patel. He's got a brand new HBO Max series called Ravi Patel's Pursuit of Happiness. He's not only the host and the subject, he's also the executive producer, and he will be with us live a week from Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Nathan, when you do title music, you also have to work with the people doing the title sequence. How does that work? Do you go to them? Do they come to a company like Imaginary Forces, by the way? I think did the title for the Americans. Do they come to you? You come to them? What is the process like to have a meeting of the minds?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess I could do a shout out at this point to Lisa Boland and the Elastic crew, who did such an extraordinary job with the visuals, and the beautiful job they did with the visuals, even in their rough form, was really a big part of inspiring me to write what I wrote. And so they were sort of working quite a while to find exactly the right length and style of the visuals. And while they were doing that, I had some storyboards and some initial animatics that really helped me decide that this pipe organ, along with choir, would be a great way to go. So there wasn't, other than the length of it, there wasn't much back and forth, because obviously they sort of have the time they have, and then I plug into that musically. But they were great. I mean, that is such a beautiful visual main title, and they deserve the Emmy nomination for sure.
Yeah. When you are composing episodic scores for a show like The Americans, or for a show like Hollywood, or for Carnival Row, what is the process like now compared to 7 years ago when you had the double nomination in theme music?
I mean, it's largely the same. I mean, I got to say that one of the most the Hollywood main theme was one of the more stressful main themes that I've had to write, just because we were really under the gun and the visuals were changing so much last minute. And again, the visuals of that are really extraordinary, with everyone climbing the Hollywood sign, and the metaphor of that is so beautiful. But they were shooting that on the stage while I was trying to write with Alexis, guiding me in terms of what themes we were going to use on that climb up the sign. And so there was a lot of back and forth, but we did get to the finish line on that. And we recorded brass, like saxophone, trumpet, trombone, very much in the style of that time. That's kind of how that worked out.
Yeah. With any show that you do, Nathan, how much involvement do you get with the creators? For example, when you were doing The Americans with Joe Weisberg and Joe Fields, two marvelous producers. We had a great time with them. They were on our show, and I'm so thrilled that the Americans finally got their due, not only with the Peabody, but the Emmy Awards down the stretch in the final year or two. How much do they contribute to you and you contribute to them? What kind of a back and forth do you have with people like that, or people like Ryan Murphy?
Yeah, I mean, with Ryan Murphy, I deal exclusively with Alexis, who he delegates to handle especially the music side of things. She's just really good at that. There's a huge amount of back and forth with Alexis. Same with the Carnival Row folks, Travis Beecham, and various others. And on The Americans with Joe and Joel, we were constantly going back and forth communicating. They were asking me to adjust things. I was sending them ideas. And so, yeah, with score, it's obviously such an important element to any show or film. And so I think it's in the best interest of everyone to be super involved with one another. And Joe and Joel, of course, were in New York when I was doing The Americans. I was in L.A. And so we were having weekly chats, if not more, based on whatever I was working on that week. And they were very they're great. They're great directors, because they don't sort of discuss musical, specifically musical notes, as much as they do sort of emotionally what they're looking for out of the cue, and that really frees me up to to interpret that however I would physically. And I think that's oftentimes the best way to direct a composer is with the sort of more emotional ways that the score needs to plug in, rather than I don't like flute or I don't like piano, which sometimes is not necessarily the truth. They may just not like flute or piano played in a certain way.
What do you think about your fellow Emmy nominees in both categories, theme music and episodic music?
Oh, I mean, they're all great. Everyone who's nominated this year is a really, really strong candidate. Sid Khosla, who's nominated for song, is a friend of mine and did such a brilliant job with This Is Us. And I'm friends with most, if not all, Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross. I know Atticus. It's just like kind of we're rooting for each other, and it's a nice place to be in.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see the music scene right now with episodes? It seems that people are trying different things. There seems to be more experimentation, the kind of music that you do. Like you mentioned with Carnival Row, for example, using a choir, which hadn't been done in a long, 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 long time. I mean, I have to go back to Wyatt Earp to think, oh, choir, or Jim Bowie, another Western from the 50s, from the City Producers, by the way, to do a choir thing. How do you sort of size up the scene overall in terms of television music?
I mean, just like the strength of television storytelling is sort of at a real apex right now. I think when you think of the idea of television and you throw in streaming and all that, we're seeing some of the best stories told in the most effective ways we've ever seen on television. You see a lot of filmmakers moving over into television because they want to try their hand at the longer format. So I would say, as far as making a generalization, that the storytelling, the music, and all the production elements are at the tippy top they've ever been in TV. And it's a really an exciting time to be a part of that. I think if you talked about scoring back in the 80s and 90s, it was a slightly different thing than it is today. And I think that goes for a lot of the shows, too. Certainly there were groundbreaking shows back then. But it just seems like TV is constantly getting better and better and better. Whether I think of shows like some of the shows I've been on, or The Crown, or just Game of Thrones, or any of these, I mean, these are as good as any film in the same genre, and I don't think many people would argue that.
Yeah, we haven't had Robert, the composer of Game of Thrones. I would love to have that man on. His work is marvelous, and not just on Game of Thrones, but on other shows he's been involved with. He really is also a very he's really become a very versatile composer in terms of his style and his and the way he uses his instruments.
Absolutely. Ramin is great. He's also just a really, I've met him a couple of times, a really lovely human being too, which is always nice.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Nathan Barr. He is the award-winning composer. His credits include The Americans, True Blood, Hemlock Grove for Netflix. 7 years ago, he was nominated twice for the same category, the Primetime Emmy Awards, which was theme music. This year, 3 nominations. 2 in theme music again for Hollywood from Netflix, the Ryan Murphy series, as well as Carnival Row, which, by the way, will be coming back for a new season, which was supposed to be in production now, but unfortunately the pandemic passed things along. And he is up for an episodic score for Hollywood as well. By the way, the Emmys are on September 20th on ABC, hosted by Jimmy Kimmel. It'll be virtually from Los Angeles and goodness knows wherever else. We'll keep you posted about the plans for that. Also, there will be 5 Creative Arts Emmys presentations that will be the run-up to the Emmy Awards. If you want to find out, incidentally, about all the Emmy Award nominees, here's where you go online, www.emmys.com. That's E-M-M-Y-S, plural, www.emmys.com. We have a few more minutes with Nation, and if you have a question or comment for him, well, make that call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Remember, coming up on our show Monday, we will feature the brand new series, News Nation, the 3-hour primetime block that begins on September 1st on WGN America. Anchors Joe Donovan and Marnie Hughes will be with us, and we'll get a survey of what's going on in the smart TV programming world from Whistle Out spokesperson Sherry Riggs. That's all coming up next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. Be with us and be interactive with us right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Nathan, earlier this week, we said goodbye to, I think, one of the best TV composers of the 70s, 80s, 90s, Billy Goldenberg. He was nominated for, believe it or not, 25 Emmy Awards, mostly for his made-for-TV movie and his miniseries work. Some people might know the great movie Queen of the Stardust Ballroom, but he was also a great TV theme composer like yourself. He did Kojak, he did Harry O, he did Ghost Story, a lot of the themes over the course of his career. Did you have a chance to, by the way, hear his work? And if so, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I knew him from Kojak, just as a kid growing up, seeing like reruns of Kojak, and just what a great, memorable theme that was. And he really plugged into that time period in a really, really cool way. So yeah, he was an incredibly prolific, incredibly wonderful composer. And yeah, I'm sorry to see him pass, but he, I guess he was 84. So what a great run.
Yeah, he died here in New York. He had been in and out for many, many years, but in the last couple of years, he was a New Yorker and a great one. And by the way, I really think Kojak is one of the great New York theme musics, a musical theme.
Oh,
it had that
yeah,
New
no
York
question.
Kind of sensibility from the opening notes.
No question. Yeah, no, it was really great. Loved that theme so much. One of the other things I'd mention, just to go back to the Carnival Row, if I may, that score and that main title features this very special piece of Hollywood history, which is this 1928 World's Cathedral organ. And I spent the last 6 years restoring and building an 8,500 square foot building to house this instrument. This is the instrument used by everyone from Bernard Herrmann in The Day the Earth Stood Still to John Williams in Empire of the Sun. It's the organ you hear when She Gets Married in The Sound of Music. It has this incredibly beautiful history in Hollywood film music, and was all but forgotten about, and then I found out it existed, and started this crazy adventure of having it restored and installed. And I used it in the House of the Clock on its walls in 2018, my collaboration with Eli Roth, and then had a really wonderful opportunity with Carnival Row to use it again in the main title, which was exciting because the producers came over and heard the organ at my studio and got really excited about incorporating that. So it's Danny Elfman used it in The Grinch recently. The Danner Brothers used it in The Addams Family. So it's finding its way right back into Hollywood film music history in a really exciting way.
When you use an instrument like that with so much musical background, does that give you pause? It's like you have to take a deep breath and like, oh boy, now I'm going to play this.
No, it's the opposite. It's just like really exciting to have it at my fingertips and to sort of explore all of the incredible sounds it's capable of producing. It's not just pipes. It's actual drums, a real marimba, xylophone, glockenspiel, sleigh bells. It's a huge, beautiful, crazy, mechanical wonder that is capable of just creating so much. And so it's been so fun to explore that. And as you can hear in the Carnival Romaine title, like that entire cue is driven by the organ with a little bit of violin and choir. So everything else you hear in that cue is that organ. And it has an incredible ability to sound like an ensemble without sounding like the traditional pipe organ we all think of.
Nathan, do you ever see YouTube and go back and see some of the classic television episodes where you had people like a Bernard Herrmann, a Franz Waxman, John Williams, or at that time Johnny Williams, Elmer Bernstein, Jerry Goldsmith, you know, create themes and create great episodic scores?
Yeah, you mean do I go back and watch like videos of them making that stuff, or
either making it or seeing what they did, you know, watching the episodes with their music?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it I just know already, just from growing up and being a kid. So yeah, I mean that stuff, all that music is so inspiring, and there were so many great themes growing up. Like it's funny, the Incredible Hulk theme from the 80s was like something that really stayed with me when I was a kid, and so many others.
Yeah, by the way, that was by Joe Harnell, wonderful band leader for many, many years. He did the great version of Fly Me to the Moon, which my parents love. They still have the record. But it was very special because who would have thought that a piano theme at the very end of every episode would turn out so great? And it was a stroke of genius that Joe did, a pianist to do that for a superhero show, incidentally. And I thought it was
amazing.
A great person to do that.
Yeah, no, and I love people who like that and think outside the box or sort of approach something in a way that has people wondering, oh, is that going to work? And then it just becomes a stage setter for others to try that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm happy to. I think some of those episodes of The Incredible Hulk are on YouTube. If not, please get them on because there's some wonderful musical work by Joe Harnell the composer on that series. Maybe before we go, what's next for you?
Carnival Row Season 2, I'm just starting up on. I have a show, another show with Ryan Murphy called Halston, which stars Ewan McGregor, which I finished the pilot for. I have a film on Netflix called Kate. And I have a documentary with Eli Roth called Finn about the decimation of the shark population. And a couple other things going on. So it's been really busy, and that's exciting.
That's a lot of good stuff. And Ryan's not really cooking with Hollywood. He's got Ratched coming up also, I believe, in September on Netflix. And we're looking forward to seeing Sarah Paulson and how she portrays that iconic character from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Me too, and with a really wonderful score by my very good friend Matt Quayle, who's a wonderful composer. So.
Oh, yes, we had Matt on. Of course, Matt did the wonderful music why am I blanking out? Of course, the Robbie Malick series.
The Politician.
Yeah. You know, Sam Esmail's wonderful show.
Mr. Robot,
Mr. Robot. I wrote for a moment.
Yep.
Mac did a marvelous job with that series. And I don't know. Did he get nominated, by the way, for the final season score?
He did not for the final season.
Ah, too bad. But he should have.
He deserves it.
He's gotten some nominations. But that final season on USA was sensational. And I'm looking forward to what Sam Esmail does with Bouncer. But Mac is a fantastic composer. And looking forward to more racing in the future. And, Mac, we'd love to have you back anytime. We had you when you did Mr. Robot. And we'd love to have you back, as we did with Nathan, anytime. And again, the Primetime Emmy Awards 2020 version, hosted by Jimmy Kimmel, September 20th on ABC, on your local ABC station, with the Creative Arts Emmys happening earlier in the month. We'll keep you posted on when. If you want the full list of all the Primetime Emmy nominations, go to www.emmys.com. That's www.emmys.com. And, of course, if you want to catch Carnival Row, find out more about that series, one of the two shows that Nathan Barr was nominated for, go to www.amazonstudios.com. And for Hollywood, www.netflix.com. It's amazonstudios.com for Carnival Row, and for Hollywood, netflix.com. Nathan, congratulations on all three nominations. Good luck to you and everybody in those categories on September 20th. It's been great having you back, and congratulations on a wonderful career you've been having. Your work is just marvelous, and you're welcome back here anytime.
Thank you so much, Simon. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Anytime, Nathan, anytime. Take care. Have a super weekend.
You too. Thanks so much. Take care. Bye.
Absolutely. Nathan Barr from Hollywood and Carnival Row and so much more, joining us live from Greenwich, Connecticut. And now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week, which was music-oriented, by the way, for the last week and a half. And we have our latest winner, our fourth in the last 5 weeks. It's George Crowley from New York, New York, and he got the answer to this question. Name the theme song of Who's the Boss? By the way, we posed the question last week. We did not know that Sony is working on a revival of Who's the Boss, involving co-star Tony Danza as well as Alyssa Milano. The answer, Brand New Life, which was written by the creators of the show. The lyrics were Martin Cohan and Blake Hunter, with the music done by other people. So again, the answer, Brand New Life. That's the theme song of Who's the Boss, which is becoming a remake possibility at Sony. We'll keep you posted on that. And our winner, George Crowley of New York, New York. Congratulations, George. You're going to get the Discovery Real Life sticker book, Ocean Oriented. Great for Shark Week, which comes on next week on Discovery Channel. And the TV book original, How We'll Live on Mars, by Stephen Patrasche. We will get that out to you ASAP. We have a brand new classic trivia question for you on Monday. Let's see if we go for two in a row or fifth in 6 weeks. You know how to do it. Tune in the program, hear the question, and if you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and where you're emailing from, and if you're first with the correct answer, you will be the winner. Okay? If we don't get a winner by the end of Monday's program, we will post it on Tuesday at Facebook under Simon Applebaum and also at Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, in order to win, you've got to play in. So do so, and all the very best. This is Dwight Mitchell Live. We have a home all about the tube. We are wrapping up our first week of Year 14 as the PokemonLaw.tv's current and future. And if you like what you hear, well, let other people know that we're online 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, Mondays and Fridays, others too, in some weeks, on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, plus we'll replay on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. And coming up in our next half hour, we're going live to Toronto, Canada. You'll meet the people behind a new series that's been a hit in Canada for the last year or so, and now it is on the CW. It's called Corridor. Move over, Jack Clement and Quincy. There's a new forensic expert in town. We will speak with the creative executive producer, Morgan Berner, and we will have the executive producer and lead director, Adrian Mitchell, both live from Toronto, as we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio, all together reaching more than 45 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Don't forget, Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker are your home for Sports Time Radio. I'm sure we'll be live about the PGA Championship, which, by the way, ESPN's coverage has just gotten underway as we speak for day number two. In case you haven't heard, Tiger Woods had a good round yesterday, 68. He is three back of the leaders at 2 under par. We'll see what happens. I believe he's going to be on the course over the course of ESPN coverage, which runs until at least 10 p.m. Eastern time. So Sports Time Radio, they'll have NBA, Major League Baseball, the whole kid and caboodle. Tonight, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, Sports Time Radio, only on blogtalkradio.com. And remember, best beat your 24/7 at youtube.com. Welcome back to the final half hour of Tomorrow Be Told Live. Night Edition coming your way on this Friday afternoon of August 2020. Simon Applebaum with you live from New Weather, New York. 78 degrees at the top of the hour. Beautiful day here in the Big Apple. Have some rain early this morning. And we invite you, if you like, to participate in the program with our next pair of guests. All you got to do is make a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. And by the way, welcome to those just joining at the top of the hour. Happy to have you aboard. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Over the past 13 years of this program, we have featured many of a show that was produced in Canada and running first on Canadian television, then later on American television, and syndicated all over the world. Shows like Flashpoint, shows like Durham County, and shows like Bellevue, which was presented last year on WGN America. Well, the latest example of a Canadian show making its way to the United States is a show that premiered on the CW this past Wednesday night called Coroner. And yes, it is about a forensic expert. And this time, unlike Quincy and me with Jack Klugman, it's a woman who's at the center of the action. The program is on the CW Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Joining us live from Toronto, Canada, are the two women who made this show work. First up, the creator and executive producer of the program, Morwen Brenner. Morwen, welcome in.
Hi, Simon. Nice to be here.
Great. It's nice to have you with us. And that other Heidi just heard is from the other person involved with this series in a big way. She's not only an executive producer, she is the lead director. And this is her third time on our program. She was with us when she did the award-winning series Durham County, and then when a show called Bomb Girl starring Meg Tilly premiered here in the United States on Reels Channel. It's a pleasure to welcome back to this program, Adrian Mitchell. Hi, back to you, Adrian.
Hey, Simon. It's great to be on again.
Same here, and this is, I think, your second show with each other, because you both did Bellevue together.
Yeah, we worked on Bellevue together. That's how we met, and how actually it was our gateway to Coroner together, I think. Adrian?
Well, yeah, exactly. We got to know each other well and our sensibilities well from Bellevue, and my company optioned the books by the UK author M.R. Hall, upon which the series is based, and we really, really connected with the main character, who in the books, she's also called Jenny Cooper, and I thought, wow, I think Morwen, given my experience with her, could really, really, really do something with this series, and I gave her the books to read, and the rest is history, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Morwen, how different is this corridor from what Jack Klugman did years ago on Quincy?
Very different. I mean, Quincy is a bit of a distant memory for me, but I love that era of shows because it was the beginning of shows that brought the characters' personal lives into their jobs in a way. And so that's something that's really true in our show. you know, our system up here is a little bit different. A coroner's not like a medical examiner. They're the person who, like, is responsible for figuring out really what happened. They speak for the dead in a way where it's like they go out into the world, they talk to the people who knew the person. They unravel the mystery from a point of view that takes in the police and the pathology reports in a really sort of holistic way. And our coroner, Jenny Cooper, like Adrian said, it's based on a series of books. And the thing that really we've retained is the spirit of this woman. And the thing that drew me to the project, because I've worked on cop shows before, a show called Virgin Blue. I've worked on medical shows. And what I really loved is that this unique, there's a spiritual component to speaking for the dead and an exciting component that's like tinged with a real sense of responsibility. So the character is very driven, but we also are really in her personal life. Like her, she's a widow. She's recently widowed. She's a young mother with a teenage son. And she's really a fascinating mix of vulnerability, of anxiety, and also incredible persistence. And like, also she's really funny. And so I feel like there are similarities because I feel like coroner shows have always been about conflicted people. It takes a particular kind of strength and quirkiness to work with the dead. So I feel like there is actually an interesting line through that. There's a Canadian show called Da Vinci's Inquest that's very iconic about a coroner. There's a line through all these shows that really is about who is this fascinating person who chooses to speak for the dead.
Yeah. And Adrian, if there's a connection among Da Vinci's Inquest, which had a great run both on Canadian television and in syndication on American television, and Coroner and Quincy, is that you have very strong central characters that have a very interesting quirk. In the case of Jack Klugman on Quincy, Jack used the show to really to advocate very number of different social causes that were brought up under the cases. So there was a lot of muckraking and a lot of, the system is terrible, let's do something about it with this particular situation, whether it was drug abuse or whatever. In the case of Coroner, what was important to have the lead character be, and how did that determine who, in fact, plays that character?
Yeah. Well, I think that after reading the book, one of the characteristics of Jenny Cooper that really I was very drawn to, and I know Maureen was drawn to, is her struggle with mental health. I think there's so many stereotypes around people who are who have experienced trauma and are depressed or have extreme panic attacks and anxiety, that there's this kind of stereotype that these are non-functioning members of society, that they're a drain on society and they're sort of not productive. What I really thought was really fascinating about this character is that she is struggling so much with her mental health issues and trying to find the right dose of medication that will help her move through, trying to have positive, encounters with her therapist and trying to figure out ways of bringing that through to all of her very sophisticated and complicated cases, never in mind her complicated personal life. We found the journey of her being so high functioning, given her mental health challenges, quite inspiring and quite fascinating, and actually perhaps more realistic as to what's happening out there in the world. I think you'd be surprised as how many people who strive and are high functioning members of society still are really dealing with all sorts of interesting and challenging mental health issues. So insofar as that, trying to figure out who to cast, well, our wonderful casting director, Lisa Parrison, after reading this script, really had Surinda Swan in mind at the top of the list. We actually auditioned Surinda Simon alongside of Anna Paquin, or we considered Surinda alongside of Anna Paquin for the lead in Bellevue. And so I got to know Surinda a little bit there, and she cut her hair. And there was something about her coming in to the audition with her hair cut and her work that she did in the audition around mental health and how she performed it in the audition that just drew us to her. Like, she just popped for us. And, you know, so we just, it was not a difficult decision. We really, really felt she was perfect.
Yeah.
Marlon, you're the creator or adapter, because this comes from a set of books for the series. What about Serena's performance impressed you to say, that's who we go with?
Oh, my God. You know, it was really interesting. Like, Adrian talks about the audition that she did. And, you know, Jenny in the books and in our, you know, version of Jenny has a real, it's a real incredible intelligence and an incredible vulnerability. And she's, you know, she's like, there were two things in the books that really stuck with me and made me want to, you know, made me want to do this project. And one where Jenny, and we put it in the show, where Jenny is driving and she's like, I'm a force of nature. I'm a force of nature, you know? And in the book, she thinks this, and you see her thinking inside her head, this way she's trying to psych herself up to be the person she is, despite her anxiety, to go out there and do this hard thing. And then there's another moment where she's in an inquest, and this hasn't been in the show yet, but where she's so nervous that she takes her drugs, that she takes her drugs for her, like, anxiety, and she puts them inside, like, some lifesavers and, like, eats them during the inquest, trying to keep, like, her head on as she does this. And it was such an incredible mix of, like just a woman who is, like, doing everything she can to rise instead of fall, despite, as Adrian's saying, you know, struggling with this. And then when we saw Serinda, who is just so phenomenal, who is herself genuinely a force of nature, it was like this combination of incredible intelligence, incredible vulnerability, and then a real physicality. The character's incredibly physical, incredibly instinctual. You know, Serinda, like, brings another layer to a scene when she engages with it. She really does come in with a really real depth of understanding for where that character is, physically at any moment, mentally at any moment, you know, spiritually at any moment. And we just saw this embodiment of all these characters. And, you know, we just thought this woman is going to bring this character to life and bring things that we don't even know about this character yet. And it was really, it was just an immediate thing.
Coroner, by the way, has been on the CBC up in Canada for two seasons, is already set to go for a third, and the first season is now running on the CW Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time here in the United States. We're speaking with the creator and executive producer of the series, Marlon Brember, and we have the executive producer and lead director of the program, Adrian Mitchell. They're both live from Toronto, Canada with us this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Apple will be live from New York. We're 78 degrees at the top of the hour. And if you have a question or comment for our guest, don't be shy. Phone, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. On Friday, 1 week from today, before there was Survivor, before there was The Amazing Race, there was the Echo Challenge. That was Mark Burnett's claim to fame, and it's coming back through Amazon. And we'll have the executive producer, Lisa Hennessy, join us live. And then we'll speak with the chief executive of a brand new production company called Triple Squirrel that just launched a new programming service featuring talent, both scripted and unscripted, from the Pacific Northwest, originating from Seattle. By the way, one of the people involved in this venture, the 1995 Emmy Award winner for Best Actor for Picket Fences, the wonderful Tom Skerritt. We will have Leslie Grandy, the chief executive of Triple Squirrels. The name of the service is called Evergreen, E-V-E-R-G-R-N, and it's now running on some smart TV sets and smart TV devices. That's all next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, only on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Marlon, have you and Adrian gotten any reaction so far from the CW's audience about your series?
Well, yes, I mean...
Sorry, honey, go ahead.
Yes, I mean, the thing is, I love sort of eavesdropping, so... yeah, there was a really great response on Twitter, lots of engagement, really cool questions and observations. That was really, really, really fun. We did quite well in the ratings. CW is quite happy. So that's great I think it's really wonderful. So it seems to be very positive. People are liking the characters, the world. And are having real fun with it. So we'll see what happens next Wednesday. But we're really excited, Simon, really excited.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, people are really loving they're loving the chemistry between Sarinda and Roger Cross, who plays Donovan McAvoy on the show, and they're loving that, which is really satisfying to us as well. And they're also loving the moments where Jenny really gives people like hell, which is really satisfying too.
And for both of you, this is a real different experiment for the CW do, because, you know, this is not a superhero show. This is not a supernatural kind of show. This is not a vampire drama. This is not a young adult drama. This is, featuring a very mature character here. It's more of a procedural, forensic procedural. And it then also has, as you said, a lot of quirks to it.
Well, yeah, I think that it's, you know, what's interesting is that our series is, the cases that she works through, I think the way it's written and laid out, which excites me, is that the cases are there to sort of explore also where the characters are, where Roger is, where Jenny is, in terms of her, the things that she's dealing with, the crises, the sort of development, where she is with her own trauma, and there's death in her life, constantly dealing with having to sort of uncover the mystery of someone's death, encourages her to reflect back on some of her own mysteries, and there have been her own deaths in her personal life, her husband. So it's all that kind of thing. It's very, very, very character-driven, I would say, not as casey as you might suspect.
Yeah. If you stick with it, one thing that is really true is that, it doesn't have – our show doesn't have a formula. It's not a formula. It's not the same every week. It's always the show, but it evolves and changes in really interesting ways that I think audiences have been finding really satisfying in Canada. And also, we're throughout the world. We're in England, we're in Europe, we're in tons of places, and people really do feel drawn into that aspect of the show as well, I think. I hope.
Morwen, in preparation for this, I saw a YouTube interview with Glenn Larson, who was one of the key people who got Quincy Emmy Lawrence, and he mentions in the interview, which was done for the TV Academy, Television Sciences, that when the idea of a forensic detective was proposed, there were a lot of people at the various networks who said, you can't do this kind of show. It's so, who's going to watch a show about death? Death, all the way through. And I think the key to your show, and maybe the key to Quincy was, I was in that, remember that opening title of Quincy, where Jack Klugman, the character, introduces all these policemen to his hospital, the operating table, and says, you're about to enter the most interesting aspect of police work, the world of forensic medicine, and he unveils the body, and everybody falls to the table with a happy theme song. It just hit me that I think one of the things that helped was the use of humor. And in fashioning the character, I'm wondering how much humor do you use, and what kind of humor?
We do our show is actually pretty funny in places. It's funny. And humor to me, our tone is interesting. I feel like I have become much, much more interested in what I think of as the tone of life, which is where you're never just one tone. Our show has extremely upsetting moments, harrowing moments, but it also has moments of incredible love. It has a lot of humor in it. Jenny's very funny, and her sort of awareness of her own strangeness leads to a lot of humor. It's like character humor. And there's also, all of our characters are smart, funny people. And it gives the show, we sometimes move in scenes between something that's really sad into something that's sort of strange. And it really gives the show a feeling of life. And I feel life is the opposite of death. And when you have a show about death, you've got to have life in it, because this is a character who wants to live and who wants to be part of the world. And so the show is funny, It's funny, too.
Adrian, a couple of weeks ago, we had Brandi Evans on. She is one of the breakout stars of the summer on a show called P-Valley on Stars, which is getting sensational reviews. And one of the things that she said about why that show works is because you have all women directors, including women of color, and women all over the place, starting with Katori Hall, who was the creator and executive producer, which is their first television series. And one thing I've noticed about Corridor, and in fact, this is something that I think Canadian TV is going to pioneer in, is that we are seeing more women direct shows. And here you have a show where you're the lead director, the creator and executive producer is also a woman, and I'm wondering how that dynamic plays into having the kind of show you have.
Well, I think it's, I mean, I think that the, what a complicated question. Well, I mean, I think that it is a very, I think it's a very affirmative and positive, like, crazy world we live in. I mean, with, like, all of us, the gals live in, we're, I think the thing is, I don't know, I think we're kind of rule breakers, all of us. I think we kind of feel we can come at things differently. We don't feel the burden of having to tell the story of procedure in a sort of nuts and bolts way that's kind of sort of that, that has a kind of heavy, you know, incredibly intense investigative hammer to it. So we come at, I think we come at things that, you know, more instinctually, maybe it's a, I don't know if it's just, I don't know if that's gender related, but I think all of us just come at things that way. We're very, very, it's very important for us to situate the female perspective in the shows and to depict, we're very careful about how we depict the death of women, and so all of that, I think it, that really is important and makes the show quite poignant. It's very important to us to have diverse sensibilities, male and female, and it, you know, it's we've been doing this for two years, and all of our other programs, that's been a huge motivation for us. It only enriches the show. It only makes it more specific, and you feel like you're really entering into someone's real world. When there's so much specificity around race and ethnic diversity, and that comes from the writers. They, you have to bring on people, writers and directors, who speak from those diverse viewpoints. And I just think you get a, I just think the show has a real quirky, sparkling, but really poignant edge because of it all. It just, I think it's really, as a Twitter person said, it's 2020 energy, man. I think it totally is.
It is. We're in the now. We're in the now. It's 2020 energy, and it was made 2 years ago. We were ahead of the now and in the now.
Yeah.
Maureen, before we go, given the pandemic situation in both the U.S. and in Canada, I know the TV clips are starting to come back now in Toronto, in Montreal, in Vancouver. Where are things at, and when does Coroner go into year three for the CBC?
Oh, my God. You know, we are just starting prep now, and it is really a different world. Like, as people keep saying, there's the production and the COVID production, because it really does alter the way that we shoot. You know, we're working in a pod system. Everyone's wearing masks at the studio. We're having to get more studio space so we can control our environment more. And then little things, you know, we had moved the writing room on Zoom when everything shut down. And so now we're trying to figure out how to be both sort of in the ether as people are now working and in the physical realm, because production is so physical, and to keep everybody safe, which is the most important thing. So it's been a huge challenge, and we have an amazing, our producer, Suzanne Colvin Golding, and our production manager, Sarah DeLine, have done an immense amount of work getting us ready for this situation. So we start shooting, what's our first, is it the September 14th, Adrian, we go to camera?
Yes, don't remind me.
I know. So, but it's nuts. Like, it's very really interesting. It's a privilege to be able to work during this time, because so many people can't even work. So we're really conscious of trying to preserve this situation where people can come back to work. But, like, you know, at the studio the other day, there's no more. One of the great perks of working in television is there are always snacks and coffee. And I quit coffee, and I was trying to find, like, tea. There's no communal kettle anymore. And Adrienne sweetly came out of her office with her mask on, put the kettle halfway between us. I came out and disinfected it and made myself a cup of tea. And it's like, it's a new world.
It really is.
Yep, we are definitely in the world of the next normal, new normal, whatever kind of normal you want to say. But at least it's happening. TV production is coming back all over the place. Yeah.
It is happening, and you know, and it's a revolutionary world in other ways too, you know, and what's happening right now in terms of racial justice. And so we really feel very fortunate that we can come back at this time and try to reflect some of that in the show.
Mm-hmm. Episode 2 of Corner premieres this Wednesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on the CW. Check your local listing for where the CW is in your area on broadcast television, including here in New York on WPX-TV, Channel 11. For more details about the program online, www.cwtv.com. That's www.cwtv.com, which, by the way, is where if you can't catch the episodes live, you can catch them on that website and also on the CW's digital app as well. Margaret Brickner and Adrian Mitchell, thank you both very, very much for coming up. Congratulations on getting Corner off the ground here in the U.S. of A. and on the 2 seasons you've had so far, and hopefully more of a big long run in store ahead. And thank you both for coming on. We'd love to have you back anytime you like. It's been a delight.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure speaking with you, Simon. Okay.
Thank you
so
much.
Bye-bye.
You're welcome, Adrian. Take care. Have a great weekend.
Take care.
Bye, Simon.
Mark Bremner and Adrian Mitchell joining us live from Toronto, Canada. Before we leave you, very quickly, we have a little feature called the Takeaway of the Week. We started this in the late stage of year 13, where on some Fridays we give you an item that we think you should take away from for the week, and because it can impact the TV you watch in the future. In this case, it's the decision by NBC to have a little bit of a juggling of its executives, some people leaving, some people being promoted. Why? Because it looks like NBC and CBS and all the other broadcast networks have come to the conclusion, you know what? Broadcast networks and cable networks are not going to be the big players they used to be. It's going to be the smart TV programming services and the smart TV sets and devices. And what's going to happen? You're going to see more original programming go first on Peacock, more original programming go first on HBO Max, more original programming go on CBS All Access. How much more? We'll see in the months and years ahead. And that's our takeaway of the week. Thanks to all of our guests for being here and all of you for listening. Don't forget, coming up on Monday, we will have the weeknight anchors of the new WNU America series, News Nation, premieres on September 1st, Joe Donlin and Marty Hughes. And from Whistle Out, talking about smart TV sets, device and programming services, spokesperson Sherry Riggs. And 1 week from today, Lisa Hennessy, the executive producer of the new Amazon version of Echo Challenge, and Leslie Grandy of Circle Squirrels, the chief executive that's working on the programming service, Evergreen, that just premiered on smart TV sets and smart devices. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on an episode you missed, go to the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. blogtalkradio.com/televised. And anytime this weekend, check out our episodes on podcast. All of our episodes from this year, not just over this past year 13, but this year and before, you can get it at not only blogtalkradio.com/televised, but at iTunes, Apple TV, the Speaker Podcast app, TuneIn.com and iHeartRadio.com. If you're going on TuneIn or iHeartRadio.com, put some I'll Be Televised, the name of the search bar, click, and then you get our episodes. What do you think about our episode today? What's your thoughts on where TV's at and where it's going? Let me know. SimonApple04@Yahoo.com. It's SimonApple04@Yahoo.com. Don't forget to include your name, where you're from. If you're going to be involved with our Classic Trivia Contest, that's the email you use. And don't forget, you can also find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at UBCSimon. TWBT. We love hearing from you, and we do it solid in 24 hours. Why? Because what you say matters. The views expressed here are those of the participants, not those of Block Talk Radio and other distributors of this program. Our production associate, Mandolin, Andy Toad's Block Talk Radio's general manager, Jay Steinberg, head of content, and the co-founders of Block Talk Radio are Al Levy and Bob Charish. Tomorrow, we televised is brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Division. Audible transforms the way you hear the world. For two free audiobooks and much more, audibletrial.com/televised. For tomorrow, we televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for living a fantastic weekend, wherever you may be. We're back on Monday, 3:30 Eastern Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to between now and then, please make it safe, make it great, and let's lift the pandemic now and forever. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.